The second half of the book flew out of me in 5 months.
Wow.
Every night I'd go in the den, I'd come out, and the characters were now really well developed. They were talking to me.
Yeah.
They were telling me what they were going to do next. Some nights I'd come out and I'd be in tears.
Welcome to the American Grown Podcast, hosted by Austin Sullivan. The American Grown Podcast will focus on people from different walks of life and their journey to where they are now. Now, turn up your volume and settle in for a great episode.
This is the American Grown Podcast, recorded inside the ColorTech Creative Solutions Studios.
In this episode, we have Paul Bamba, author of the novel No Lifeguard on Duty. Paul, welcome to the show.
Austin, good to be here. Or Sully, I guess.
Yes. Oh, thank you. You could definitely call me Sully.
Okay.
That's like in school and growing up, friends would call me Sully,
yeah.
Teachers, my parents, and any kind of authoritary figure would call me Austin, you know.
Okay.
But please, Sully is more than welcome.
Great.
So you kind of corrected me off air, and I wanted to get it on the recording. I said you were from Stroudsburg,
yeah.
But it's, how do you properly say it?
Down in Strasburg, they say Strasburg. And yes, that's where the railroad is.
Strasburg. Strasbourg. That's like when people come in and they say Lebanon, and it's like, no, it's Lebanon, or
yeah.
Lancaster, it's Lancaster.
Right.
So, and that's one of the top railroad enthusiast destinations in the country.
Yes, it is, because they have the historic railroad there, and also the Pennsylvania Railroad Museum right across the street.
Is down there also, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful area. I mean, Lancaster County in general is very beautiful. And then, again, off air, we discussed, how did you hear about the podcast?
Well, my neighbors, Grant and Nicole Holden, did a podcast with you about their natural birthing, an app that they've developed. And they told me about it, and I just filled out the form and sent it in.
That's awesome. Yeah, and shout out to Grant and Nicole if you're listening. They were on episode 54, and the app was Dude Doula, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And you're 100% correct, a birthing app.
Yeah.
Great people, you know.
Terrific
real salt
people.
Of the earth
great
people.
Great neighbors.
Good, that's good. Yeah, yeah. You don't want them to not be good neighbors, you know. And then I wanted to also mention, before I meet a new guest, I try to do some research, you know, how to pronounce people's names. Paul, obviously, that's no problem.
Right.
Bamba, I wanted to make sure I got it right. So I did Google pronunciation, how to pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bamba comes up and I'm saying it correctly.
Yes.
You know, Google, you know,
yep.
Confirmed it. You confirmed it.
Spot on.
Yeah. Yep. Now, I didn't realize if you translate that in Spanish, Italian, and Polish, it means your last name is the bomb, like bomb.
Right.
So, Paul, you're the bomb.
I
you know?
Am the bomb.
You are the
and
bomb.
Yes,
yeah.
It is Polish. So.
Is it Polish? Oh,
yeah.
Cool. I wasn't
yeah.
sure if Italian or Polish. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's start in. Tell us about your time growing up in Asbury, New Jersey.
Yeah. Asbury Park, New Jersey.
Thank you for the correction. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm originally from and was born, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. So just about an hour north of us here. When I was 9 years old, my father decided we needed to move. There wasn't a lot of work up there. So he somehow found Asbury Park, New Jersey, which was a pretty well-known resort town on the Jersey Shore and had been for about 100 years or so. Now, when you say Asbury Park today, most people think of Bruce Springsteen, and he sort of put it on the map for many reasons. But when I moved to Asbury Park, I thought it was great because I'd come from Appalachia, basically, and
mm-hmm.
It seemed like the world there was in black and white. And here I am on the Jersey Shore. I can go to the beach. There's rides and amusements on the boardwalk.
More light, vibrant.
Very vibrant and just a whole different thing. And I loved the town. I loved living there. And I came of age there. I lived there until I was about, until I went off to college and then still used it as a home base until the 80s. So just had a wonderful time there. It was really a beach life and a carnival life.
Okay. And you have a love for Bruce Springsteen and his music.
I do, but I'll tell you, I was not the biggest Springsteen fan. The biggest Springsteen fans are called Spring Nuts.
That's, oh, I didn't know
their club name. And the funny thing about the whole Springsteen influence is I went off to college, and again, another local connection here, I went to Franklin and Marshall. And I hadn't really paid much attention to Springsteen. He had just become a big thing in like 1973. I'm in college in 1974. People are talking about Springsteen. And well, as soon as I heard that, and I knew he was from Asbury Park, of course, I pretended that I knew a lot more about him than I really did. It was a good way to impress young co-eds, for instance. So,
yeah.
So all of a sudden, I became kind of a Springsteen guy. And then it sort of hung, he sort of hung with me after that.
Okay. And he has so many hits, like Born in the USA.
Yeah.
And I know some of his, which we'll get into, music inspired your first novel.
Yeah.
No Lifeguard on Duty.
Yeah. If you say Asbury Park, people think Springsteen. If you say Springsteen, they think of often his first album, which was Greetings from Asbury Park.
Okay.
And they also think of an iconic postcard that is on the album cover. You can tell my age because I'm talking about albums, right?
A lot of people would not know what albums are.
Let's just say vinyl.
Vinyl, okay.
So the vinyl. And there's a iconic old postcard that is has the words Asbury Park spelled out on an arc, and it had little pictures of town scenes in it and everything. So people think of that. The other thing they think of on his second album, which was The Wild, The Innocent, and The East Street Shuffle, there is a song called 4th of July, Asbury Park, and in parentheses, it's Sandy. And the song is filled with beach imagery. I can almost recite them. The boys from the casino dance with their shirts open. The switchblade lovers on the circuit, you know, they're so fast, so shiny, so sharp. You know, the tilt-a-whirl on the South Beach drag, this fortune teller that was there, Madame Marie. So he painted those pictures sort of for me. And it ended up having quite an influence on it. So a lot of people think of that song and they think of those images, and they ended up being, to some extent, in the book.
In the book, okay. And what was life like growing up in Asbury Park? You know, what'd you do in school, sports, things like that?
Yeah. So, like I said, I was in fourth grade when I moved there, and I went to a school that had been the former high school of the town, built in the 1890s. But when I got there in 65, it was home to like first through eighth grades.
Okay.
And I did play basketball and soccer. And I guess I played softball or baseball or something too. And I was there until eighth grade, which would have been 1970. And that's sort of where the story of the book begins, because I'm a 14-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. I'm living in this town that I love because of my beach life. And that's summer of 1970, the 4th of July, 1970, which again, that date keeps coming back when you talk about Asbury Park. I'm lying in my third floor bedroom at night, and I'm thinking to myself, this is so cool that I live here. Someday I'm going to write a book about this. Just about kids being on the beach, and this will be really cool. It was sort of adolescent nostalgia.
Yeah, definitely.
And then, coincidentally, in the wee hours of that night, I started seeing red lights from police cars flashing on the ceiling of my room. And I heard sirens in the distance. And I had this sense of foreboding that something was happening that might cause me to lose all of that.
Yeah.
So when I woke up in the morning, I found out that there had been race riots that had occurred in the southwest part of the city. And I started thinking about somebody other than myself at that point, which is unusual for a 14-year-old.
Definitely.
But I started thinking about the families who were in that part of town and what they experienced. And then it was a big tourist town. So I was thinking about these tourists that came to town for the beach, rest, recreation, and they got something they hadn't bargained for. Now, it didn't really change my idea about the book at that point, but as I got older, it occurred to me that writing about kids on the beach wasn't much of a story. but that maybe writing about the different families who were in town that weekend and experienced those riots in different ways would make a real story. And that's what the story ended up being about.
So this goes back to you being in your bed as a young child, really. I mean, yeah. In your teens, you know.
14, yeah. 14, yeah. Your mind's just wrapping itself around who you are.
Yeah. And this is a part of history that you live through. Do you remember, you know, waking up the next morning, what was on the news? What was going on? You know?
So this was actually a big deal. Now, there were race riots across the country in the 60s, but most of them were in big cities. To the extent that people, and people in New Jersey and New York City knew about Asbury Park, but it had something of a national reputation, too. It's even made its way into a old Cole Porter song and a musical. Is it the Lido I see, or is it only Asbury Park? So it got national treatment. And on the New York television stations, they had video of the violence and all that stuff. And I will tell you, if you have access to the old Lebanon Daily News from that first week of July 1970, there were headlines in the Lebanon Daily News about the riots in Asbury Park. So that was really, it changed the course of history for the town, and to some extent it changed my history.
Yeah, it sounds like it had a big impact on you and your life moving forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, some of it was, I mean, living where I lived in that sort of black and white world, and I don't mean that racially, in Appalachia, it was an ethnic community. It was Polish and Slovakian immigrants. Everybody was white. And I moved to Asbury Park, and the school I was in was interracial. And the funny thing is, I don't ever remember having that make an impact on me. And I think for the first 5 years, I didn't know that there was such a thing as race issues in town. But there was a southwest corner of the city that was all black, and it was a ghetto, and it was very depressed, and that's where the riots occurred. So that summer of the riots not only threatened my beach life, but made me become aware of the issues of race and to some extent social class in not just Asbury Park, but our country. So that had a big impact on me. And then I went to high school, and it was very much an integrated school. And that was another transition, because I started high school the September after the riots had occurred. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what was it like then going back to school or going to school, you know?
Yeah. So it was, I think all that summer there was this sense of apprehension and tension in the town. The riots only lasted 4 or 5 days, a week at most. And I think people were just concerned, because now there was going to be more mixing of the races and more sort of intimately in the school setting. I'll just say this. I mean, my high school experience, I don't have a romanticized image of it or an idealized image of it. It was not easy for some people. They didn't fare well. For one reason or another, I escaped I escaped the worst of it, because at times there were fist fights and things like that.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I will tell you, my high school experience was a good one, but I guess I found the right people and the right people found me, and I am better for that that experience, having that that time where I had black friends and white friends, and we accomplished a lot together, and because of that, I think we developed empathy, because you don't develop empathy for another person who's different from you by just sitting in a room with them.
Yeah.
You do it by accomplishing things with them,
whether spending time with them, teams, I'd imagine, yeah.
Whether it's academic clubs or what have you. So it had a big impact on me.
And then, so how did you find Franklin and Marshall?
It's one of those crazy life things. Like, how did my father pick Asbury Park to move from?
Yeah.
I don't know. you're a kid graduating from high school, you don't know anything about college. Back then, it's not like it is today where the parents are all involved. And
more education and more awareness.
I picked a bunch of schools off of some list that somebody gave me. I applied to a bunch of them. F&M seemed like a great thing. And to some extent, that was another life-changing experience. I had great years there.
And in what way would you say it was life-changing?
Well, so I was a public school kid. And this was another lesson in what you would call today, although it's an unpopular term, diversity. So I went to a school where, even at that time, there were a lot of prep school kids. The average, you know, net worth of the families there was quite a bit more than mine, even at that time. So I had a new social set. So again, back to race and class. I had my racial diversity experience and my social class diversity experience by going to F&M. But it gave me some direction. I ended up going from there on to graduate school and then became a professor and all that. And that's just some of my other stories.
You are now embarking on your third career.
Yeah.
Which is phenomenal. I applaud you for it, because a lot of times I feel like as people, you know, as you get later stages in life and you're looking into retirement, nothing wrong with it, but people just maybe hang out at the golf course, or they don't pursue further things, or they don't get creative. You know, writing a book is very creative and it takes time. So what were your other two career paths prior to writing your first novel?
So from the time I was at F&M and then through graduate school, I went to Brown, and then from there I went on to university in Texas, and I was a faculty member. So my first career was an academic career. And I taught courses and I did research on child development, memory, perception, vision, things like that. And I did that for 3 years in Texas. But, you know, I was trained as a scientist and I enjoyed it. I was analytical, but I just didn't have that passion for it. So after 3 years there, I moved back east and I decided to get into business, and I got a job at a company in Morris Plains, New Jersey. It doesn't exist anymore. It's been broken up. A Warner Lambert company. And then 3 years from there, I got a job at the Hershey Company just down the road here.
Yeah.
And I spent 27 years there. And I retired in 2015 as vice president of their research and development portfolio. So I hung out at the golf course, and I was obsessed with getting better at golf, and I practiced and played down here at Fairview and all over the county and everything. But that idea that I had on the 4th of July in 1970 was still there, and I describe it in my readings as being like sand in my sneaker. It's a good metaphor, because if you have a little sand in your sneaker, you don't always shake it out. You leave it there because it kind of reminds you, hey, I was at the beach and I had a good time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the way this was for me. That idea was there. It sort of bothered me, but it reminded me of being a beach kid and running around on the beach and the boardwalk and all that stuff. And then it reminded me of being a young man, you know, chasing girls on the beach and the boardwalk. So it was mostly a positive thing, and I was pretty content with it. But, you know, when something is with you that long, it tells you that it needs to be addressed. And sometime in the late 2010s, 2020, I decided there were a lot of feelings attached to the idea that had to do with a sense of loss because of the riots, that had to do with just the losses that come with life. And I thought, if I don't shake this sand out of my sneaker, if I don't write this story, I'm never going to be at peace with some of the sense of loss and some of the emotions that were attached with it. So I finally sat down and started to write.
Yeah. So to go back when you were a professor, because on the form, you put one of your interesting facts or subjects. If I'm correct, it was on there. JFK Jr. was one of your students, or you ran into him in Texas, maybe? How'd that work out?
So God rest his soul.
Yeah.
He was... when I went to Brown, actually, I was a teaching assistant That's how I got my money to live on while I was in graduate school. And I show up to teach this psych, you know, introductory psych laboratory, you know, where there you've got rats pressing levers and people measuring reaction time and things. And who's in the back of the room but JFK Jr.? And so, I mean, I didn't get to be close buddies with him or anything, but I thought, well, this is kind of cool. So whenever people say, tell us something unexpected about yourself, I use that because that's pretty unexpected.
That is a pretty good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, again, from Asbury Park, history there, the country, to JFK Jr. I mean, history is, you've intertwined with history throughout your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the book ended up being a historical novel. Okay. So the basic story starts the night of the riots, July 4, 1970. And there are three teenagers who are friends, unlikely set of friends. At the beginning of the book, a cop stops him on the street and he says, a colored kid, a tourist, and a townie. Something's not right here.
Okay.
Because you wouldn't have seen those three groups together as friends necessarily. And I'll just say, the language of the day would have been colored kid. You know, that's what my father would have said. That's when it, you know, that was really even before black or African-American or people of color would have come into vogue. So the story revolves around those three kids and their families. Back to what I talked about before, they each were ended up experiencing those riots differently. You've got a wealthy tourist from New York City. She's experiencing the tourist family experience. You've got a black kid who's kind of from the marginal area of town. He's not right in the heart of the riots. And you've got this sort of blue-collar, middle-class white kid from the east side of town that would have experienced it differently still. So the story revolves around them. And I think the way the back of the book describes it is the riots that occurred through those three teens into turmoil. They were dealing with their own family issues, their racial, social, cultural identities in the midst of all this chaos. And the punchline is town and teens would never be the same.
Yeah.
So that's the essence of the story.
Okay. And when writing the story, did you ever picture yourself as the townie?
Yeah, I mean, that's I talk a little bit about this in the afterword of the book. The backstory of the Dobek family is Polish-American, like me. The story ended up being about the families. You know, you have these three families coming to that fateful time and place from three very different places. One, like me, came from Appalachia. The other, his family had first come on a slave ship and then migrated north to find employment after the Civil War. And then the wealthy family from New York, they were immigrants too. They were Irish immigrants who'd made their way in the world in New York City and been successful. And now they vacationed in Asbury Park. So you have these three families, these three kids all come together, which is very American, right?
Yes. Oh my goodness. Okay. Yes. A melting pot, you know?
Yeah, a melting pot. So there they are. And these riots occur and they all experience them differently. And it at least temporarily, if you think of those three storylines of those three families as weaving together into a strand or into a rope, three strands, the riots come along and pull that apart. Okay. And now it sort of unravels, their friendships unravels. And I won't spoil the story, but it turns out that they will forever be intertwined in some way.
Yeah. Paul, let's take a sip break.
Yeah.
This sip break is brought to you by Garage Beer. From the garage to the cooler, whether you're on the golf course, just got done cutting your lawn on a hot summer day, or spending some quality time on the grill, grab yourself a Garage Beer. It's just beer-flavored beer. the title, No Lifeguard on Duty, how did you land on that title? Because I'm sure there's so many different titles and wording that you could have went with.
Well, you know, it's funny. I started writing, and the first half of the book took me about over a year to write. There was a lot of research involved. The first half of the book kind of covers the riots, not just day by day, but almost hour by hour. And I read another guy's book along the way. It's nonfiction. It's The 4th of July, Asbury Park, A History of the Promised Land. And it's by a guy by the name of Daniel Wolfe with two F's. And it because it was nonfiction, I used a lot of what he'd done there to figure out the history of the town. And what occurred to me is that, you know, whenever riots occur or wars occur, people want to know why. But it's not really a rational thing. People are operating on emotion. And the emotions that drove people to riot on that particular night had a history in the town. And back to your question, the town's stewards for 100 years had ignored the problems on the west side of the town. They thought they could just control them and keep them under wraps. The title ended up being a metaphor for that, and then for other characters in the book, that they were lifeguards for that town and they were not on duty. They didn't do what they would have needed to do decades before the riots occurred to keep that emotion from boiling over on that night. Because it's not rational, right? People always say, well, why did they burn down their own part of the town? Well, it's because they'd lost all hope. And it wasn't all the entire part of the town. It might have been 20% of that portion of the town. Just look to their left, look to their right. They had no hope. Nothing was changing. It had never changed. This was all they knew. They didn't see a way out.
Right.
And so why not burn it down? Who cares? You know, and we've all had those times when we've done something rational, self-destructive. But again, back to your question, my premise was that the lifeguards for that town were not on duty for decades.
Yeah, so the stewards of the town, it was almost like it was being swept under the rug and put off to the side and finally came to a boiling point, it sounds like.
And everyone knew what the problems were. The housing was substandard. It was truly a ghetto. Mm-hmm. There was an irony that was painful to that community, that the families who ended up there had come there for work. They worked in big old Victorian hotels in the town, and wealthy people came and spent time there, and they were the kitchen help and the porters and the chambermaids and so on. And when the town started to change and the tourist trade changed, that part of the community was left behind, because now it was impossible for someone from that area of the town to get a job on the east side of town. So their families had come there and helped build the town. They were now being left behind. It was painful. So a white college kid like me could go there and get a job on the boardwalk. If you were from the west side, you couldn't. So, you know, that was very painful, and it drove some of the issues.
Yeah. How do you look at race and the social impact it has on our society today?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I said before that I guess maybe late 2010s, 2020 is when I sat down and decided to shake out that sand. When I do my talk on this, my reading, I say, well, all those nostalgic, bright, sunny memories of the beach and the boardwalk and all that, started to, as I got older and I started realizing that we were dealing with the same issues 50 years later, it started to bug me. So the sand in my sneaker got uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that was going to be, I needed to sit down and tell this story, because I think seeing that the issues are the same as they were 50 years ago, yes, things have improved, but we're still dealing with the same things, and the root causes of them are the same. So I think that was one of the reasons to write the book. The only thing I'll say, though, is that the book is not it's a novel, so it's fiction, and it doesn't preach a point of view on race or class, okay? It simply says this was my experience through these fictitious characters. This is what I observed. Maybe if you read this, you'll think about your own experience and reach your own conclusions about race and class. So that's the way race and class plays into the book, and that's the way it plays into our society today. These two factors are always there. They always generate emotional, not always rational responses. So I think if you really want a good story, but you like to think a little bit, this is a really good book.
It's a perfect book for you.
Yeah.
Being in your third career path, you know, retiree, what has that journey been like writing your first ever novel?
Yeah. Well, so I do describe it as just that. It's a 50-year journey. And when I give my talk, I say I'm here to answer three questions. Why did I write a book? Why did it take 50 years? And why is it 480 pages long? And I think I've sort of already answered why I wrote the book. It was somehow a need or a passion that I had to discuss not necessarily these topics in the abstract, but my experience with them. Mm-hmm. So it was self-expression. And then it took 50 years because I'm driving down the road of life. Springsteen's in the back seat, strumming along and singing and reminding me, you know, that I got to go somewhere. And so I'm going. And I've got a corporate career, I've got a wife, I've got a family, and that idea is still there in my sneaker. And I finally sit down and decide I'm going to get it out. But think about it. I had no formal training in the craft of creative writing.
Right.
None whatsoever. So the other factor in all this, you ask, you know, what was it like? It was a little bit threatening. If it hadn't been threatening, I would have done it sooner. I just didn't know that I had the talent to do it. And then I got into it and I started to gain confidence. So the first part of it is you're gaining confidence and thinking, okay, I can do this. You know, I had somehow worked communicating my entire life. I made presentations to senior management. I had written papers that were scientific. So writing and speaking, but it was all analytical. I hadn't ever just made stuff up. So that was a little threatening. And once I started doing it, I liked it. So it started out as threatening. I gained a little confidence. It starts to be fun. I said the first half of the book took about a year. It was hard. The second half of the book flew out of me in 5 months.
Wow.
Every night I'd go in the den, I'd come out, and the characters were now really well developed. They were talking to me.
Yeah.
They were telling me what they were going to do next. Some nights I'd come out and I'd be in tears because, you know, you're expressing all these feelings and emotions through these characters, and it's just exhilarating. So I finished the book. I'm 66 years old.
You look great for 66 years.
Thanks. And I'm thinking, okay, so now what do I do with it? And I never thought I would publish it. I honestly thought I was going to put it in a binder, give it to friends and family, and let them sort of learn a little bit more about me and my experience and all that.
Yeah.
And I gave it to a guy I was a roommate with at F&M. And he, first of all, what impressed me is he finished the book in 2 days. It's a 480-page book. And he calls me and he says, "You're going to be on Oprah."
Yeah.
And he said, "This is a great book. You had me from the first sentence, from the first paragraph, from the first chapter, right through." And is somebody, okay, this guy loves me, but I also know him.
He's a straight shooter?
Yeah. He wouldn't yank my chain, and he wouldn't, you know, say something that he might lead me along. So I had to rethink the binder thing. I said, this thing, and it wasn't the only experience. I started getting more feedback that, you know, you really should do something with this. So I had a choice. I could start writing query letters to literary agents to find an agent. I could then wait for the agent, assuming I could get one. And that's not easy, by the way. People send them books all the time. Everybody my age thinks they have a story to tell, and they want to tell it, and they think everybody should read it. So there are too many books. The agents are overwhelmed. And then if the agent gets one of the big five publishing houses, and there are really only five really big ones with the resources to market a book the way it needs to be done, that would take more time. I'm 66 years old. I said, you know, this thing could just, you know, I could die before this thing ever sees the light of day. So I started looking into other ways to do it, found out that there used to be something called self-publishing, and it kind of had a bad reputation because people did everything themselves, and it often wasn't professional. But now there's this whole industry out there called author services. And so there are people who can help you publish a book, and anybody can publish a book on Amazon and another technical entity called Ingram Spark. And if you're on Amazon, you're selling on Amazon and a bunch of other booksellers, online booksellers. And if you're on, if you're with Ingram Spark, any bookstore, you walk into one in Lebanon and they could order the book for anybody who wanted it. So
yeah.
So anyway, I ended up publishing it. I screened on paper about 100 different author services people. I got it down to three. I interviewed them and I picked who I thought it was the best one. And they end up being kind of silent partners. They don't really show up anywhere in the book. If you open the book, it says it's published by Bumper Car Books. That's me.
Okay.
I am Bumper Car Books. And so Bumper Car Books. It's, you know, it was, so I not only had to learn how to write creatively, I then had to learn how to publish, and I had lots of professional help. These are all people who worked in publishing industry their whole lives. So they're real professionals. And then the hard part has been I've had to market it myself. And one of the things you do to market it is come and do podcasts.
Yeah. And here we are.
Yeah, and here we are.
Yeah, here we are. Yeah. I want to, two things. Your wife's first name?
Flair, F-L-E-R-E.
Shout out to Flair.
Yes. Yeah. She also went to Franklin and Marshall.
Okay.
So we met there and had a hiatus for about 5 years and then got back together. We got married in 1986.
Yeah.
So we've been together 38 years.
Oh, phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned, was it Bumper Car Publishing or Bumper Car?
Bumper Car Books.
What? Do you like bumper cars? Or
well.
What's the meaning, I guess? Or what is the...
So through this story that I'm telling you, you'll notice there's a lot of beach imagery, right? No lifeguard on duty.
Okay.
So yep. It described that role of the town fathers, but one of the points of the book is that everybody, every community, but also every person needs lifeguards. And the good news is anybody can be a lifeguard.
Yeah.
So bumper cars are just another thing that you associate with, you know, the beach and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It was a cool old ride and everything. But
yeah.
While I'm on a roll about the lifeguard thing, because it's very important, the lifeguards who are on duty, you hope, are like parents and friends, right? It's in the job description.
Right.
But there are lots of characters in the book. Some of them not the primary ones, some of them the primary, some not the primary, some even cameos who play the role of lifeguard. They just take an interest in somebody. You know, they want to give them a chance or they bail them out or something like that. So that lifeguard imagery, which led to Bumper Car Books and everything else, and the title No Lifeguard on Duty, is just throughout the whole story. But I'll tell you, I'll let you get to your next question. But before I forget, we're talking about all this stuff. At the heart of it all is this is a really cool story. It's involved, it's intricate, and people tell me they love the characters. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. But
yeah.
I'll let you drive a little bit more. I'm going to take a sip.
So. Let's take a sip break. Okay. This sip break is brought to you by Garage Beer. From the garage to the cooler, whether you're on the golf course, just got done cutting your lawn on a hot summer day, or spending some quality time on the grill, grab yourself a Garage Beer. It's just beer-flavored beer. So No Lifeguard on Duty, obviously it's an entertaining read, you know. Yeah. It's a novel. It had, collected 6 honors, including 2 gold medals during award season. Tell us a little bit about that.
So once I decided to start marketing the book, I got some advice to submit it to some competitions. And in the independent publishing industry, which is, it's now indie publishing, which replaced self-publishing, is now a huge part of books. And there's a whole, there's some prestigious awards. So I didn't apply, didn't enter into any of the competitions that were the kind where everybody gets a medal, you know, like T-ball.
Right.
So I entered, I think, 4 or 5 competitions, ended up getting 6 awards, 2 gold medals. And this also started building my confidence that this book was good. And then I started getting reviews on Amazon, and I started getting some other reviews and putting together my marketing materials. And I thought, you know, this is a really good book. And I'll tell you what the readers have told me. One of the things they like about the book is there's actually, because there are 3 families, there's like 3 interwoven stories.
Yeah.
So you're following each one independently, but then they touch each other. And, you know, you're kind of in it, weaving in and out of these stories. It's a little bit like a Netflix series, right?
Yeah.
Where there's always like 2 or 3 different storylines.
Well, I love a good Netflix series.
You're
yes.
watching one and you know there's something going on with the other group and that whole thing. So that's one thing. And then the other thing in the reviews that people talk about, there are just some great quotes. Something like, I feel like I know these people. You know, they seem like people I know. They seem real. The other thing is they say, I kind of feel like I want to know what happens next. The book ends on purpose with some dangling sort of semi-loose ends that might lead to a sequel, say.
Oh, okay.
And people say, I want to know what happens to Muriel. I want to know what happens to Greg. You know, and so people, they start to identify with these characters the way I did in my den, you know, when on those nights when I'd come out kind of teary-eyed, because they start to be real to you. And what happens with me is I think about these characters every day, and some of the reviews and the readers who've I've had people contact me through my website and just tell me that, you know, I just love these characters. I think about these people. I finished the book 6 months ago. I'm still thinking about these people. So
they're hooked.
So I think it's very entertaining because the intricate storylines and the characters, you really get involved with them. So
yeah,
and that's why it's won 6 awards.
And where can people purchase the book?
So around here, probably the best thing to do is to get onto Amazon and buy it there. But you can also go into any bookstore and ask them if they have it. If they don't, say, I want to order No Lifeguard on Duty by Paul Bamba. They'll look it up. And anybody can get it for you in a couple of days. If you're somebody who frequents the Jersey Shore, there's about a half dozen stores down there who have it. My flagship store is the Asbury Book Co-op in Asbury Park.
Okay.
They've probably sold, they've got to be getting close to 200 copies there.
Wow.
And there's another place called Thunder Road Books. Cool name, right?
Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen.
Thunder, yeah.
Which is in Spring Lake. And there's Booktown in Manasquan. There's a whole bunch of stores down there. Now, I don't know if this means anything, but in January, I'm going to go to a new Barnes & Noble that's opened up down there, and I'm going to do a signing there.
Oh, very cool.
And so I'm hoping that if that happens there, that then it'll maybe show up in more Barnes & Nobles and that kind of thing. But you could walk into a Barnes & Noble now and say, I want to get this book, and they'll get it.
They'll get it for you. Yeah. Yeah, do you know the date, or it's still too early?
Like, no, it's already out. It's actually, I published it in 2023, so it's been there for a while. And it's
I meant for the year author signing.
Oh, for the author signing.
Yeah, in the new year, right? Yeah.
Yes, January 12th. I'm at Barnes & Noble in Eatontown.
Okay.
And I've been doing readings all over the Jersey Shore. And I actually have another one at the Neptune Library the day before the Barnes & Noble thing. where I kind of tell this story in a formal format with slides and old pictures.
Yeah.
And read from the book and stuff like that.
Okay. Now, Paul, if you could shout out one person that has been a mentor in your life, has been a lifeguard in your life.
Yeah.
Who would it be?
So, the obvious ones are my parents. Before we started recording today, I mentioned to you that, you know, this is the American Grown podcast. Well, mine is an American Grown story. So the neat thing is in the book, although this wasn't the major time frame, I actually go back to the grandparents of these three kids to describe how they got there. And the character in the book that is Adam Dobek's grandfather is modeled after my grandfather. He was a peasant in Poland, literally like an indentured servant tied to the land.
Yeah.
Didn't live with his parents. Somehow he makes his way around the turn of the century to the U.S. He goes to the area around Wilkes-Barre, and he works in the mines, and he has his family. So that's sort of classic of that generation. Then my father and mother come along, and they are classic greatest generation. They somehow, as infants, dodge the Spanish flu epidemic, the early 1900s. They live through the Depression and survive, even though both families are very poor. World War II comes along. My father enlists. He ends up flying airplane. Well, he doesn't fly airplanes, but he's an airplane mechanic, and he ends up getting volunteered to be a gunner in a bomber. So he's got people shooting at him over the Pacific. My mother's back home playing Rosie the Riveter, welding airplanes together in a plant up around Buffalo. So the war ends. My father comes back. He becomes an auto mechanic and settles into this coal town up there. He'd had to quit high school in 10th grade because my grandfather was hurt in the mines and he couldn't work anymore. So, but he just keeps, one of the phrases I use in the book, he just keeps making his way, finding his way in the world. And, you know, he did that, and then I sit here today. So he was a good lifeguard.
Yeah, truly the greatest generation. You know, they did so much back then. And just even, you know, with my grandparents, and I knew my great-grandparents a little bit, but like, they were, family was so close. And, you know, it was such a tight-knit community. Everyone cooked meals, you know. It's amazing how society and culture and life changes, you know, and it's almost like you kind of lose some of that. And it's a shame. I don't know what happens, but, and every family's different, but it's really something.
Yeah, one of the things that we talked a little bit about social class, this isn't true of everyone who's successful in life, but because some people remain humble and grateful, but some people who are successful, they forget about the lifeguards in their life, the people who gave them a chance, not just their parents, but maybe, you know, I had a professor at F&M. I didn't know what I was going to do, where I was going to go. He really got me into Brown, where I got my graduate degrees. So he was a good lifeguard. But a lot of times people who are successful, they like to attribute it to themselves, and they should be proud because they've worked hard. But they were blessed with good genetics, probably born into pretty good families like I was, and then probably had some mentors and lifeguards along the way. But they often don't really give them credit. And so I think one of the things that has to change in our society is that I think everyone needs to practice a little more gratitude and grace rather than grievance. My father didn't complain. He didn't. If anyone could have felt aggrieved by the way the world had treated him, it would have been him. But instead, he just played lifeguard.
Yeah. So. Full circle.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it, Paul. So the items you brought with you, let's talk a little bit about them. Obviously, the book, No Lifeguard on Duty. You brought your hat, F&M hat.
Right.
But you're wearing Asbury Park Football Club soccer, volleyball. What's going on there?
So this is pretty cool. Great. This is American entrepreneurship.
Okay.
It's got a badge here that says the Asbury Park Football Club, referring to football, soccer.
Soccer, okay.
And there is no such thing. There's not a football club in Asbury Park. Well, there might be a club, but there's no club that plays. But this guy had a marketing idea. People yeah. know the town, they, you know, because of the Springsteen things, and it's having a revival now because of a number of things, just the music scene there. And he basically sells these shirts, and it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. Like, they even have, like, trading cards for the guys who play okay. on this club. But there's no such
But it's club. Not real.
It's not real. But as long as you ask.
It's a cool jersey. Yeah,
so
yeah.
there are a couple things. It's a beautiful jersey.
Yeah.
And there's a patch over the left breast, like there often is on soccer jerseys, Asbury Park Football Club. And it's got this funny character in the middle of it there. That's Tilly.
Tilly? Okay.
And Tilly is a famous cartoonish character in Asbury Park. He used to, it was a picture, a cartoon-like picture on the side of an amusement building down there called the Palace Amusements.
Okay.
It's not there anymore. It's been torn down. But people who know Asbury Park know about the Palace Amusements, and they know about Tilly. He's an icon for the town. So I'm wearing my Asbury Park icon over my breast there. Now, what's harder to see is that there's this intricate design on the shirt, and it's hard to describe this, so I'm going to use this as a chance to pitch the book. In the book, I describe some of the architecture in the town that was built in the 30s, and one is the casino. It's mostly fallen down now. Beautiful, beautiful building when it was built. And there's a part of it that's still left. It's an old carousel house, and it's like got a copper roof, and it looks like a crown that a king would wear.
Yeah.
And it's got glass and copper all around the outside of it. Well, this design on the front is a really, really neat depiction of the copper and glass design of the carousel house on the casino. So if you know the town, and when I go to my local author discussion in Asbury Park tonight, I'll wear this shirt. Everybody there will know that yeah. is the carousel house at the casino, and that is Tilly.
Tilly.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
And honestly, I thought it was 100% a real team.
Oh, you yeah.
know, because
yeah.
it looks so legit. I was like, oh, I got to look these guys up. Like, yeah. well, and I love the colors and yeah. everything.
Well, check yeah. out Asbury Park Football Club online. I don't know that they still have this shirt, but I think they're still designing shirts and selling them to fools like me who will buy them.
But they're also, I think a lot of people would, because it is such a neat, you know, design.
Oh, yeah, and soccer's like a big thing now.
Oh, it's definitely, like, yeah.
My
yeah.
son's a big soccer player. He's got an Asbury Park football.
Does he? Yeah.
Club. Actually, it's
they
a
got playing cards?
It's a family thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, my son, my daughter, and my wife all have Asbury Park football
yeah,
club shirts.
That's
they,
awesome.
Yeah, they have to be Asbury Parkers by birth, I
by
guess.
Birth, right. Birth,
birth,
right.
And marriage, yeah.
So now how can our listeners connect with you on social media?
Well, I'm a dinosaur, so I'm not really on social media except LinkedIn.
Okay.
But I do have a website, so I'm kind of an up and, you know, well, that's probably, you know, 2 decades old that people had websites. But yeah, so the website is paulbombabooks.com. And if you go there, there are some old pictures. There's some bio information about me. You can get to links from other interviews I've done. You can get to links. The Lancaster newspaper did a beautiful article on me in the book when I won one of the awards back in May. And so you can get a link to the Lancaster newspaper's article about the book. There was another article written in New Jersey Stage. You can get a link to that. So anyway, there's all sorts of stuff there that'll tell you more about Asbury Park, more about me, more about the story. I think the way it's described on the website is it's a coming of age tale and a family saga on the Jersey Shore. So, people from the Jersey Shore love it, but what I've also found is anybody who has a nostalgic feeling about a beach that they spent time on in their youth loves the story. They get those feelings of nostalgia. And almost everybody has some kind of nostalgic memory of
oh, yeah.
a beach town that they frequented. And There's a lot of that in the book. You will get that. The sights, the sounds, the smells, and everything. You can smell the cotton candy and the surf. Oh, and
I can picture it.
And listen, you can hear those squeals of the people in the water when the waves come. That's all in there.
It's all in the book. So if you can't get away, you know, maybe you're busy with job, family life.
Yeah.
Buy No Lifeguard on Duty, read the book, and let it take you to the beach.
Yeah, and I'll give people a hint. If you're cruising online and you forget any of it, this book, Sully can attest to this, on the front of it, it has an Asbury Park lifeguard stand.
Yes.
On the front of it. I think the cover is beautiful, by the way.
I do too.
But then again, it's my book. It's sort of in beachy colors, that sort of sea blue, sandy brown.
It's very eye catching. Yeah,
eye catching, and it's got this empty lifeguard stand on it because the lifeguard there is not on duty, and so that's the one you're looking for. There's other books named No Lifeguard on Duty. Mine is not the one about the first supermodel. So it doesn't have the half-naked woman on the front of it.
Okay.
So you might be disappointed about that, but it does have an Asbury Park.
A beautiful beach scene, you know. Yeah, for sure. Paul, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
I think the only thing I'd say is, if there are any aspiring writers out there, don't wait 50 years to do it. But if you do have a 50-year-old idea, do it. You'll feel better. I've learned so much, and I've met so many people like you, Sully, just as a result of the book. There's just something about books, this book in particular, that makes people respond, and they just reach out, and they contact me through the website. And another thing that happened, I'll just do a little digression here. I had my 50th high school reunion back in July, and I had not been in touch with a lot of those people. Some I had been friends with up until the 90s and the 2000s, but you know, I had a reunion with a guy that I hadn't seen for 50 years, who was a good close friend of mine. He happened to be black. Used to come into my house and we'd listen to music, all kinds of music. And for some reason, you know, life just takes you in separate directions. So what I'm getting at is that the book has I've learned a lot. I've developed new skills. I've applied my old business skills to marketing the book. But the best thing has been the contacts I've gotten from readers, people who told me how the book affected them. And as a result of that, I've made some new friends and renewed some old friendships.
Yeah. Paul, it's been great meeting you. I appreciate your time, you know, getting to know you. Grant and Nicole, if, you know, like I said, if you're still listening, shout out to you both for introducing us, really getting us connected, you know. That means a lot. So I'm going to close it out.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Sully, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Paul Bamba, author of the novel No Lifeguard on Duty, thank you so much for joining me.
Great. Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. To see photos of today's guests and more content, just search American Grown Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to be a featured guest on the podcast, please direct message or email Austin at AmericanGrownPod@gmail.com.
This episode was brought to you by these sponsors.
Cleona Coffee Roasters is a small batch coffee roastery and coffee shop, veteran and first responder owned, community oriented, and roasted fresh to order. Now open inside 911 Rapid Response, Anvil, PA. Go to CleonaCoffeeRoasters.com to order online, see updated hours, and find where you can buy it close to you.
Triggered 22 LLC, a veteran owned apparel company. By purchasing a t-shirt, hat, or hoodie from Triggered 22, you're not only supporting a small business, but you're bringing awareness to veteran PTSD and suicide. Please help save the lives of those who fought for our freedoms. Visit triggered22.com now and place your order. Let's help those suffering from invisible wounds.